The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. Good morning. I'm Vic McCunis. We've got the Book Nook coming up for you, and today a very special novel by James Renner. It's his second novel. It's called The Great Forgetting. We had him on the program a few years ago for his first novel. It's called The Man from Primrose Lane. A lot of things have been going on with that. In fact, it's being turned into a television series for Fox. And we're going to talk to James about that television series for his first novel and this extraordinary new novel, The Great Forgetting. But first, let's check in with National Public Radio. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and this morning I'd like to welcome to the program James Renner. His novel, The Great Forgetting, has just come out in paperback. He joins us by telephone from somewhere in beautiful northern Ohio. Hello, James.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Welcome back to the program.
It's nice to be back after our talk several years ago on The Man from Primrose Lane.
That's right, we had you on for the first novel, and in that novel, you introduced me to the Loveland Frog, and I'm forever indebted to you for that. I had never heard of this creature.
Oh, it's such a bizarre local legend. I had to put it in the book because nobody, you know, you have your vampires and your werewolves and your ghost stories in any town that you go to, but nobody has the Loveland Frog except for Ohio, this half-man, half-frog creature that supposedly lives in the Little Miami River around Loveland. It's very, very creepy and bizarre that it's based on some sightings that occurred in the 1970s.
And the Loveland Frog makes an appearance in that novel. And as a matter of fact, I seem to recall that that was a big part of the plot, actually, the mistaken Loveland Frog. It's been a while since I read the book, but I hear that things are still going on with that book. Isn't that like being an option for television or something?
Yes, yeah. Right when the book came out, Warner Brothers snatched it up. It was going to be a movie for Bradley Cooper. And then, they couldn't quite make it work as a feature film. So we took another stab at it here last year. And long story short, Fox has picked it up for television, and hopefully it'll be on as a new limited TV series sometime in 2017, sometime this year.
That's pretty exciting. Are they going to let you do any of the screenplay work on that?
Yes, I'm heavily involved in writing the adaptation for television. It'll be 10 episodes per season. The first season will be based on the first book, and subsequent seasons will be based on future books, hopefully. And I've written the first two episodes, and we're working on the final eight.
Subsequent seasons, gosh, James, I see retirement in your future, man.
I would love that. Right?
James Renner joins us. The second novel, The Great Forgetting. Wow. I love this story. How'd you get the idea for it?
Oh, thanks. The Great Forgetting deals with this concept called phantom time that I think I remember learning about first when I was a college student at Kent State University, and it just always kind of stuck with me. And it's this idea or theory or conspiracy theory that at certain times in our history, the leaders and people in power kind of messed with our official calendar. And for instance, there's some scholars who believe that Pope Sylvester, who was Pope around the turn of the first century, or I'm sorry, the first millennia, so he would have been Pope at AD 1000. There are some scholars who believe that he was actually Pope in the early 900s and wanted to be the Pope for that turn of the millennia, so he inflated the calendar and had the official calendar skip ahead by like 90 years so he could be Pope for that transition. And so you've got a chunk of 90 years, like say year 910 AD to 1000 AD, that we essentially skipped over and just never existed, which would mean, right, that today, present day 2017, isn't technically 2017, but more like 1927. So it's this trippy idea that the year that we live in might not really be the year we think it is.
Cool. So the stock market's going to crash in 2 years? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Go into savings and bonds.
And I'm enjoying the roaring 20s.
And it takes that concept into present day, and it asks the question, if we had the ability to forget the worst things that our government has done, would we as a society vote to essentially let the government erase our memories? And yeah, I think recent political stories and elections have shown that, yes, I think there's a great angry minority that would absolutely give the government power to wipe our minds if they so chose.
Hey, I'm all for it. The
if
book
we
is
could just forget 2016. That would be a start. Maybe.
There you go. The book is The Great Forgetting, and it's a very appropriate title. Okay, set the stage. It starts off in a little town in northern Ohio. Is this a real town?
Franklin Mills is not a real town anymore. It is based on the town I grew up in. But Franklin Mills was actually the name of Kent before it became Kent.
Oh.
So I always kind of liked that name, Franklin Mills. And so I've used it and hijacked it as this kind of fictional small town in northeast Ohio. And, you know, all my books kind of, you know, there's a character that's from there or you'll go through it. So it's kind of the connecting thread of everything I write, this mm-hmm. little town. And, yeah, The Great Forgetting, the main character is a history teacher from Franklin Mills. His name's Jack Felter. And he teaches history. And his best friend from high school has gone missing. And the general consensus in the town is that he walked into the quarry to drown himself, to commit suicide, except his wife doesn't think that that's really the case. So Jack ends up being pulled into the search for his old friend, Tony, and in order to find out what really happened to him, he has to interview Tony's last patient. Tony was a doctor in a mental health ward, and his patient is this young man who believes in all these conspiracy theories that, you know, the government is putting mind control chemicals in our fluoride and using planes to send mind control chemicals down from the air, and all the conspiracies you can think of this kid believes. And so, but he also seems to have the clues that may lead Jack to finding his old friend.
But Jack really delves into this as sort of a sidetrack because he's come back to town. He's avoided it because his good friend Tony married his girlfriend, and he's kind of stayed away because there's some bad blood there. And then Tony's disappeared, and Sam, the ex-girlfriend, he kind of swiped her from Jack, and Jack and Sam still have some feelings. And then there's Jack's dad, who is my favorite character, and he's really the reason why Jack comes back, isn't he?
Yeah. Jack's dad was a Continental Airlines pilot. He was he flew in Operation Baby Lift during the Vietnam War, which was this effort right at the end of the war to airlift as many babies out of Vietnam over to Oakland, California, as they could before it fell. And so he's this retired pilot, but he's suffering from what appears to be some form of dementia, where he's losing his memories, and so he's kind of coming into the end there. And one of the reasons Jack has to return to Franklin Mills is to help care for his father, who's becoming a little more violent too. So, the book itself is all about memory and how we deal with memory and what memory means to us and what happens when you take away memory, like, for instance, dementia patients or Alzheimer's patients, because memory is how we form our identity, and it makes us who we are. You know, what our memories are determines our personality and how we interrelate with people. And so by taking away those memories, it really changes a person and changes their personality, like we see in dementia patients. But the greater idea for the book is what happens then when we take away memory from a society, from a whole group of people. What does that do, not just to the people, but what does that do to the country? What does that do to society?
In case you're just tuning in, my guest is James Renner, and his novel, The Great Forgetting, has just come out in a paperback. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'll continue my conversation with James right after this. It is The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, joined by James Renner on the telephone today. His novel, The Great Forgetting, just came out in a paperback. And we were just talking about Jack's dad, who most of the time you refer to as the captain. And Alzheimer's and dementia, what might be affecting him is a highly common situation for a lot of people these days. And as the book opens, the captain is kind of going in and out of mental acuity. And when he's out, a lot of times he speaks in Vietnamese. And this is fascinating. And as we kind of put it together, it starts making sense. But this is spoiler city. This is like walking through a minefield. What else can we say about this story? Come on, let's try.
The captain certainly picked up some Vietnamese when he was, stationed there in the war. He actually befriended a prostitute in Saigon, and their relationship is very, very weird, weirdly sweet. You know, it was never it was never sexual. You know, they were essentially, he was kind of, setting her up in a better place. He was tired of seeing too much tragedy, so he kind of took this woman in and made sure that her life changed for the better. And then on the last day, as Saigon is falling, she's actually murdered by one of his one of the guys that is in the military with him, that is in the Air Force with him, and he comes into this crime as it's occurring, and in a fit of rage ends up murdering this killer, and it's a secret that he's had with him. And it's the knife he uses to murder this man is something that he keeps with him, and it becomes a clue in another case later on involving his son. So it's something he tried to escape, something he tried to forget. But again, it's one of those memories that will come back and haunt him later on in odd ways.
Well, that was kind of a minor spoiler. Okay. I guess we can talk about Sam's brother then, can't we?
Yeah, I mean, everybody in this story, you know, they have, you know, there's something in their history that they would like to forget if they could do so. But but the stronger characters in the story choose to remember, even though their memories are bad, even though bad things happen to them, they choose to remember because it's through that tragedy that they became strong, that they became better people. So they need that. They need to remember that. And, you know, one of these bad characters is Sam's brother, and, you know, he's dangerous, and, you know, he did terrible things to her when they were kids, and, you know, Jack kind of rescued her for that, but, you know, she was damaged, you know, and she's the one that ends up, you know, going behind Jack's back with Tony, and then, you know, it sets up that whole love triangle that becomes so important throughout the course of the story. You know, and it's a love triangle. You've got Jack and Sam, you know, who fell in love as kids, and then Sam leaves Jack for Tony, and they get married, and then Tony disappears, and Jack comes back in the picture, and that relationship rekindles. But you've also got, you know, Jack's love for Tony. You know, he met Tony before he met Sam, and, you know, Tony was his best friend growing up, and, you know, they were inseparable as boys and explored the country on their Huffy bikes. And so, you know, there's a strong love there between Jack and Tony too. And, you know, it all builds to the end where, you know, of course it's the classic, you know, love will save us in the end. And that's where we're taken to eventually.
The book is The Great Forgetting. It's alternative history. It's science fiction. It's really a page turner. James Renner wrote it, and he joins us on the program today. And the brother, Sam's brother, he's a fairly despicable character. He's one of these people who, unfortunately, is not uncommon in small towns in Ohio and Indiana and West Virginia. He's a guy who has a lot of meth, and he likes to get other people involved with it, and he's a bad guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You know, you run into that in these small towns, you know, when there's nothing else to do. Some people turn to drugs and bad things, and yeah, Sam's brother was heavily involved in meth, and then you've got it linked even closer there because, you know, Sam's brother ends up having a relationship with Jack's sister, so it's very ingrained in these two families, and then Sam's brother kind of disappears too, and we're led to believe that it was Jack's dad who kind of chased him away from town, but that plot point really becomes important towards the middle of the book, where you find out that maybe Sam's brother didn't run away, and maybe he's not alive anymore. So that sets us up for the second part of the book, which is essentially a chase, and it's Jack and this patient of Tony's, Cole, this boy who believes in conspiracy theories, and the second half of the book is them running cross country from the government and from these secret agents that are part of this program called The Great Forgetting, who may not be entirely human even. You know, they may be somewhat of bizarre Nazi experiments that attempted to crossbreed humans with great apes. So it gets pretty fun and pretty bizarre towards the second half of the book as Jack and Cole are trying to get across country and trying to find this island that may exist in the Pacific that is called Mu, M-U.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually based on a real legend. There are scholars who believe this island once existed, and there's references to it from Plato and scholars who studied the Incan Empire believe that, you know, that they had originally come from this island Mu that was almost like a small continent, out in the South Pacific somewhere.
James, as I was reading this, you do such a great job of balancing these very serious issues, conspiracy theories, events like 9/11, mind control, and then you throw in all this humor, and a lot of it's subtle, and you also make some odd tributes that some of us might pick up. I think you had a little tribute that I picked up on to your first novel, The Man from Primrose Lane, when you allude to a prosecutor in Pennsylvania who mysteriously disappeared. You're talking about people disappearing. Wasn't that guy in that other book?
Yes. Yep, you mentioned him. Yeah, there are a couple ties to The Man from Primrose Lane. You know, I like the idea that my stories and novels all kind of exist in the same greater universe. So, you know, if people really want to get into it, they, you know, hopefully that's fun for them to pick up on.
Well, this has got big screen Hollywood movie treatment written all over it. And as I discovered your character that you call the Maestro, he reminded me of the Wizard of Oz in a little bit of a way.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. This, you know, there are these secret underground facilities, you know, down deep under the Catskill Mountains that eventually Jack and his friends find themselves kind of trapped inside. And there's this odd man who lives down there who calls himself the Maestro. And we learn that he is essentially in charge of the creative side of this government program to rewrite our memories. So, you know, they've got this giant radio station essentially that transmits the signal when they want to rewrite our memories and reset the calendar. The signal goes out and causes everybody to forget, and it's the Maestro's job then to write original memories that fill in the gaps that we have in our memory, that fill in the gaps of our calendar. So that's kind of a weird job that this guy has, and we come to learn that, you know, he's been there from the very beginning, you know, from when this program was set up, you know, 50 years ago.
You have so much fun with this. Powerful people, of course, would want to take control of this algorithm, and folks who follow politics today will get a little chuckle about who you have supposedly behind some of these machinations, this power lust, and we'll leave that to readers to discover. But we do solve a lot of mysteries. We find out who Sasquatch was, and we find out what happened to that missing Malaysian airliner. We find out what really happened on 9/11. We find out that the Cleveland Browns actually won the Super Bowl. I mean, this has got it all.
Well, I mean, it is fiction. You gotta have the Browns win the Super Bowl somewhere. But yeah, no, it's you know, the general idea is that, you know, the greater idea behind the book that you learn about the midway point, so it's not spoiling that much, and it's the whole crust, you know, the whole thrust of the book is that World War II was much bigger than we remembered, and that was because America decided not to ever intervene, and we stayed as an isolationist country, and so the Nazis were allowed to basically take over the world, and we didn't start fighting back until it was too late. So in the original history that's in this book, World War II lasts until about 1964. And then there's a period of 100 years where we're kind of rebuilding the world and trying to trying to fix everything that Hitler ruined. And so that brings the calendar up to about, you know, 2064. And it's then that this young scientist named Stephen Hawking comes forward and he says, I have this machine that will allow us to forget the last 100 years, and we can pretend that everything after 1964 never really happened. And so that's what happens, and they reset the calendar, and so it wipes everybody's memories and of this 100 years that we lost, and then the Maestro, you know, rewrites the memories to make it fit in everybody's mind. And so we kind of pick up in what we remember as the real 1964 and go forward from there. And of course, our characters in the story, in the novel, don't really start to uncover this conspiracy until, you know, present day. So it's been the truth for the last 50 years.
In case you're just tuning in, you're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Vic McCunis. This is The Book Nook, and it's my pleasure to have James Renner as a guest today. We're talking about his second novel, The Great Forgetting, just out in paperback. And James, I think of you as this wonderful novelist, but you've got a whole other career writing nonfiction. You're really the true crime guy. I heard a rumor you had a book out last year called True Crime Addict. Let's talk about that. I haven't read it.
Yeah. So that's how I got my start. I was a reporter for Cleveland Scene for 7 or 8 years, and I wrote a big story on the Amy Mihaljevic case, and that big article became my first book, and then all the other books kind of came out of there. And so I've always kind of kept up with true crime stories. And last May, my latest nonfiction book came out. It was called True Crime Addict. And it was about my 5-year-long search for a missing woman named Maura Murray, a very odd case from from Massachusetts and New Hampshire. Maura was a University of Massachusetts Amherst student. She studied nursing back in 2004. And one day she emailed her professors and said, "Hey, there's been a death in the family. Hold my work till the end of the week." And that was a lie, by the way. There was no death in the family. And she got into her car and drove north into New Hampshire, into the White Mountains. And about 7:30 that night, she got into a single car accident. A car crashed into a snowbank. And sometime between the time of the accident and the time that the police arrived is, you know, we're talking maybe three minutes, but no, certainly no longer than 7 minutes, because a number of the neighbors actually heard the crash and called 911. So sometime in that window, Maura vanished, never to be seen again. And so it's a very odd case. And like the Amy Mihaljevic case, when you really start to delve deeply into it, it's like peeling back the layers of, you know, of an onion, and it just gets more and more complicated and more complex, and all these strange characters come out, and all these you know, sad, you know, bizarre and unexpected stories seem to be a part of it. So it's a very odd case, and so the True Crime Addict is about that search, but it's also about our obsession with true crime in general lately, and you know, why that came about, and why I was interested in true crime, and you know, why I've been involved in these cases for several years, and why I might want to get away from it and do something else, like write novels about conspiracy theories and adventure and fun things like that.
Mm. Well, if I recall from our previous interview, you developed this obsession with the disappearance of Amy Mihaljevic. In fact, you were just a kid, and you were doing all kinds of weird stuff, weren't you?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, you know, the whole reason I wrote a book on the Amy Mihaljevic case is I was the same age as her. We were both born in 1978, so she'd be 38 years old now, and you know, so I think, you know, for every kid, unfortunately, I think there's that one case, you know, that abduction or murder case that you remember as that moment that you realized that you lived in a dangerous world, that not everything was as safe maybe as your parents made it out to be. And, you know, that was Amy's case for me. And I remember being, you know, when it happened back in 1989, And I was 11 years old, and I used to go on my bike and get on my bike and ride out to Westgate Mall. My mother lived in Rocky River at the time, which is right next to Bay Village, where Amy was from and abducted. And I figured Westgate Mall was the place where the most people were at any given time. So, you know, if she got lost, then she'd end up there first. So I'd go there and look for Amy. And then after they found her, her body, you know, I would go to the mall and look for her killer based on the composite sketch of the witnesses that saw this guy with Amy that day. So it was a weird obsession even back then. And this idea that I had that maybe I could solve it, that I could fix it. You know, so for all those reasons, that was the first big story I took on.
My guest is James Renner. We're talking about his work and his nonfiction as well as his fiction. He has a new novel out. It just came out in paperback called The Great Forgetting. Don't touch that dial. We'll continue our conversation with James right after this. This is the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and welcome back, James Renner, to the program today for another interview for his second novel. It's called The Great Forgetting. Just came out in paperback. A moment ago, we were talking about the disappearance of Amy Mihaljevic. I think the last time I had you on the program, you were still hot and heavy on trying to find the killer. Is this kind of subsided, or is it still sort of a side interest on your part?
You know, it's always going to be, you know, a side interest to some extent, but I really have stepped away from the true crime investigations and writings and everything. You know, I think last time we talked, I was running a blog on the case, and, and since then they've released a little more information. They came out with this new bit of evidence, this curtain that was found at the crime scene back in 1989, and they were hoping to get people to recognize this curtain. And so I put that back up on the blog, and I did a little work when that came out. But really, you know, these true crimes are not something that you want to spend a lot of your life invested in. You know, I have a lot of respect for the police detectives that, you know, where that's their job every day, and they have to go into that, and they have to work it. And but I have a choice not to do that, and you know, why would I want to surround myself with that sort of misery day in and day out? So, you know, which again comes back to the title of my last book, which is True Crime Addict, and it's that idea of an addict, and you know, why do we do these things that aren't pleasant? That why do we fixate on these stories that aren't happy, and you know, maybe we could do better if we didn't, and if we stepped away. So, you know, I hope the true crime writing that I've done has helped some of these cases. But you know, you can, you know, for me, you know, a true crime writer can write about these unsolved mysteries for their entire life and never solve one. Mm-hmm. You know, I've written about 35 different cases or so, and you know, I've been lucky enough where we've brought one case to resolution. And you know, that's good enough for me. That's more than anybody expected. That case was the young girl named Tina Harmon, who was abducted and murdered from Lodi area in, I think it was 1981, 1982, sometime in there. And that case remained open until I got involved with it, and I helped the family pressure the prosecutor to retest evidence in that case. And they ended up finding DNA of a convicted killer on her clothing, and we were able to close that case.
Lodi, is that California?
Lodi, Ohio.
Lodi, I've never heard of it.
Ashland. It's,
okay.
You know, out where 224 and 71 merge.
Okay.
Big. It's a big truck stop area.
I see. Well, it's probably a lot better for your mental stability and health to not be focusing on all that true crime stuff. It's probably
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I love the novels. I love the fiction that I get into. The Man from Primrose Lane, adapting that for TV right now is a lot of fun, and I can't wait to see that on Fox. You know, you had mentioned the Great Forgetting as a film, and you know, unfortunately, you know, I don't know that I can see that. You know, it would make a really good TV show, but there are some very controversial parts of the story in The Great Forgetting that would really be a risk for for some producers to get behind, especially this whole idea that maybe our official the official story of 9/11, you know, what if it didn't happen the way we were told? What if we weren't the heroes, you know, or what if we weren't the victims in that story? And it kind of turns 9/11 on its head, but it does it not for, hopefully not for shock value, hopefully not for, you know, just because I could. But I really wanted to say something in there, which is, you know, what I think we forget about 9/11 is how audacious it was that the terrorists did what they did, and they had a reason for doing that. They at least in their mixed up minds, mm-hmm. you know, they had a reason for doing it. Nobody thinks they're the villain in a story. You know, everybody thinks they're a patriot. Nobody thinks they're a terrorist. And so I wanted to get at what they were doing, and I really wanted to ask the question: what would it take for an everyday average history teacher from America to be pushed into doing something like they did on 9/11? What would it take a normal person? And that's kind of what the book is about.
I guess I just have this fantasy of that aging Hollywood movie star who doesn't get the leading man roles anymore, you know, like a Gene Hackman, playing the role of the captain. And I just, you know, I would just
love... That'd be a lot of fun.
Oh, man, I would love to see that on the big screen. Just, you know, pick out your aging former matinee idol who would make a great captain.
Well, you know, Harrison Ford can fly a plane.
There you go. He would be good.
Yeah. I like it.
Yeah, I think that, frankly, the Hollywood treatment would work. But you're the creator. You're the one that has to sign off on that stuff.
Hey, I'm not going to say no if somebody wants to do it.
I'll bet you're not.
I'd love to see it, too.
So you're staying really busy working on the TV show, the adaptation of The Man from Primrose Lane. Does this mean that you don't have time to be working on your third novel?
No, actually, I've written another novel that is waiting to be published. It's actually a sequel to The Man from Primrose Lane. In fact, I'm editing that right now, and that's completed. I also have a novella that will hopefully come out sometime in 2017, a very short, you know, a shorter novel that is called Muse, and it's just classic horror. It's almost an homage to Stephen King and just outright horror, and it was a lot of fun to write. So I've got some books that should be coming out in the next couple of years for sure.
You're a busy guy. Didn't you do some kind of a film treatment of a Stephen King story?
Yes. Way before I was a reporter, Stephen King has this program called the Dollar Baby program for aspiring directors, and what it is is it allows you to option a Stephen King short story for 1 year for $1. And what Stephen King will let you do is adapt one of his short stories and then film it. And you can then use the film and submit to film festivals. And basically it's to start your reel as a director, start your experience as a director. You know, because part of the deal is you can't ever make money off of it, but you can show it in film festivals.
Uh-huh.
So it works as you know, as your resume basically, and that's actually how Frank Darabont got his start back in the day. Mm. Before Shawshank Redemption, he was one of the first Dollar Baby directors, and when I heard about it, not too many people knew about it. So I was lucky and such a Stephen King fan that I heard about it, and I think I was maybe the eighth person to come along and do it. And then since then, I think there's like 50 of us now, these Dollar Baby directors. And but yeah, mine was based on a short story called All That You Love Will Be Carried Away. And it's one of the rare Stephen King short stories that doesn't involve paranormal or horror in any way. It's, in some ways, it's kind of Shawshank Redemption-like. And it involves this traveling salesman who is collecting graffiti from the stalls inside the bathrooms where he stops at rest stops, and you know, he's writing this book about this collection of graffiti, very weird story. But it starred Joe Bob Briggs, who was this national kind of monster movie guy, and as well as Cleveland's very own Harvey P. Carr was the hotel clerk.
The cartoonist.
And, Michael Stanley played the cop.
The Cleveland musician?
Yeah.
Ah.
So there's lots of fun little local cameos in this film. But you know, it's not one that you're going to find very easily. There might be some clips on YouTube, but you know, it played at the Montreal World Film Festival in 2005, and that was a lot of fun.
Well, we've never had Stephen King on the program, and I don't think we ever will. We've had his son Joe Hill on the show, but
oh, great! Yeah, Joe's real good. I read his stuff, of course. I loved Heart Shaped Box, and you know, I haven't picked up his latest one that is of The Fireman, but I'm looking forward to it for sure.
And we had him on for the book before that with the Demon Car.
Oh, yeah, Nosferatu.
Nosferatu, And I'm wondering, James, since you obviously read a lot and you write a lot, what kind of stuff do you like to read, and what's the best book you've read lately, the most entertaining?
Let's see. Right now I'm going back to I'm beginning to outline a ghost story. So I'm going back and reading some more of the fantasy, you know, kind of spooky, well-written type of stories. Right now I'm reading this book called, Mr. Norrell and Jonathan Strange? Came out a few years
Rebecca,
ago.
Rebecca Morrell, is it that wrote that?
Seems right. And, you know, about magicians during the early 1800s in England and the return of magic. And that's a lot of fun. And but I'm also reading this book I'd never heard of that is a literary classic that I'm just kind of devouring right now. It's just so well written, called Stoner. That's I have the 50th anniversary copy of it, and you know, it's one of those kind of lesser known classics, and it's written by this guy John Williams, and it's a story about an English professor's life, and you know, from a kid until his death, and very simple story, but very well written.
Stoner, thanks for the tip.
Yeah, for sure.
My guest is James Renner, and he's joined us to talk about The Great Forgetting, his second novel, which just came out in paperback, and other things. And you're still up in Akron, is that right?
Yes. Yep, I live here in Akron with I've got two kids, and my wife's here too. She's a high school choir teacher in the Akron area. And so I drop the kids off in the morning, and I go to the coffee shop, and I write, and I edit, and I do all my book stuff there. And then I pick the kids up, and we hang out, and that's kind of my routine. I taught English composition at Kent State and the University of Akron for a while, and I really enjoy that. I like teaching. I love teaching. But right now I'm lucky enough to do the writing full time. We'll see how long that lasts. Knock on wood.
Well, yeah, the writer who quit his day job, that's a challenge and an impressive one.
Thanks. You never know what the next year is gonna bring, but you know, this adaptation of Primrose Lane into TV, I mean, that's certainly the driving force right now. But I'd love to write more books. I'd love to be more known for the novels than the true crime. So, you know, we're transitioning, and hopefully I'll still be writing books in 5 or 10 years and can come back and talk about more.
I hope so. How did you do the deal? How did you get the film activity going, the TV activity? You have a really good agent?
I do. I get really lucky. You know, it's kind of a series of steps. I got my first literary agent in New York, and she introduced me to this great film agent out in L.A., Howie Sanders over at United Talent Agency, and you know, he was very instrumental in setting up Primrose Lane as a movie at Warner Brothers, and then, you know, that kind of introduced me to that world of film and TV. And I saw that Warner Brothers wasn't going to end up making the movie, and so, you know, without telling anybody, I wrote the first episode of a TV show based on the book. And I turned it into the agents, and they're very hard to impress, and, you know, they've seen it all, and you know, they said, well, this looks pretty good. Let's send this out and see what happens. And so they sent it out to a bunch of different production companies, and a lot of people were interested, and it surprised them, too. It ended up with this group called Working Title, which is mostly known for their movies. They do all the Coen Brothers movies, and they did the latest version of Les Mis, and they're a great company to work for, but they had started this TV division, and this is one of the first projects that they picked up. And so, you know, it was a series of lucky timing and coincidences, and, you know, hopefully writing that worked for them, and just let us hear. And you know, now with just a little bit more luck, it might be on TV this summer.
I will watch for that, and I am not a big TV guy, so that is something I'm going to definitely look into and check it out, James. And if you had gone back in a time machine, if you had reset the time and gone back here over 60 years to our little town, we're broadcasting on the campus station, WYSO of Antioch College, and we are a public radio station with a big signal, but back in the day when we were just a little tiny station starting out, there was a guy here on campus who went to Antioch, a young man who was very interested in radio and television, and he went on to a brilliant career in TV and a short one, unfortunately, but he's someone who I think you admire. His name is Rod Serling.
Of course, yes. In fact, in The Great Forgetting, every chapter title is taken from a title of a Twilight Zone episode, every single one. And that was, you know, because The Great Forgetting in a lot of ways it's just a big Twilight Zone episode. It's a what if, you know, what if this were true? You know, how would this change our way of looking at the world, at society? How would this change our way of thinking about ourselves? And that's what I really like that Rod Serling did. And yeah, I'm very much aware that of his Ohio connections. I spent some time in Yellow Springs when I was a reporter, actually, when Dave Chappelle kind of disappeared there for a while. And, you know, I came down to see if I could talk to Chappelle or the people that knew him. And, you know, I really liked how in Yellow Springs everybody was very protective of him. And, you know, they really wouldn't tell me much about him or what he was up to. And you go into the coffee shop, and at the time there's murals of, you know, famous people or local people in town. And, you know, their clever way of honoring Dave Chappelle was to put him on the back of the door so that, you know, you never see him unless the door's closed. So unless you're local, unless you work there, you don't know that he's part of the mural too. But during the course of reporting on that is when I learned about, you know, Rod Serling's ties to the area, and I just thought that was really cool. And it made a lot of sense to me because there's just something about that countryside and that part of Ohio that inspires, you know, the creepy stories that we used to get in the Twilight Zone and Night Gallery. And so I can definitely see its influence in his work.
Well, it's like a lot of small towns. You like the small town life, and you protect your own, and
for sure.
It's good to be able to live a quiet life outside of, you know, the media glare. And even when reporters come sniffing around, which they do, you know, we're polite and we're cordial and we don't say much. That's a great story, James.
Thanks. Thank you.
Well, we really appreciate your time today on the program.
Well, thanks for having me on again, for sure. I'll be sure to make sure you get the next book as well.
Please do. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. My guest has been James Renner, and his book, The Great Forgetting, just came out in a paperback. It's his second novel. And also watch for the television adaptation of his first novel, The Man from Primrose Lane. Thanks again, James.
Hey, thanks for having me.
For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis.